Great. Welcome, and welcome to week 17. We get to the exciting part. I mean, the truth is, so much about Shlomo has been exciting. I hope for you as well as for me. We are talking about the wisdom that God gives Shlomo, and hopefully we'll get into the story of the two women who come to Shlomo, the story with the live baby and the dead baby, and boy oh boy, is there a lot to talk about. Last week, we learned about the offer that God made to Shlomo. Hashem offered to Shlomo, "Ask me for something, I will give you." We wanted to know, why is God's offer to Shlomo? This is unique in Tanakh. And we gave various cases that are somewhat comparable, but really nothing is truly comparable. And we said it could be a test for Shlomo. I didn't really like it. It didn't seem to fit. As we discussed last week, we floated the idea that it's a reward for Shlomo because of good behavior, bringing his offerings in the Mishkan. It could be a demonstration of God's love for Shlomo, a love which preceded Shlomo's birth. And a major idea that this is a step towards the Beit HaMikdash and the utopia that Shlomo is supposed to introduce. That's important as well. Last week when I talked about that, I talked about how Shlomo's wisdom in particular attracts people to him and attracts kings from elsewhere and a queen to him from elsewhere and support that's necessary for the Beit HaMikdash. But if you take a look at source number one on your sheet, I didn't bring this source last week. The Radak says something very interesting at the end of our chapter. After the story of Shlomo and the two women, and he performs this feat of justice that impresses the world, the text is going to say at the end of the chapter that everybody is in awe of Shlomo's ability to do this, right? It's chapter 3, sentence 28. Everybody hears this and they revere the king, or they are afraid of the king. So Radak makes the point in source number one. He says, "Lefichach yara'u mipanav la'asot davara va'afilu b'seter." Therefore, they were afraid to do anything bad, even in private. Ki ra'u ki b'rov chochmato yotzila or mishpat. They said, "Oh, he's a smart one, that Shlomo. He is going to figure out what happened. I can't get away with anything." K'moshon aseb is a mishpat, like happened in his legal decision here. So they become afraid of wrongdoing, Radak says. And that is what, I think that supports the idea that giving Shlomo these gifts is going to help bring about the utopia because it's going to keep people in line. So we talked about why Shlomo in particular requested wisdom, and then Hashem gives him so much more. And we then went into the question of what it was that Hashem actually gave to Shlomo. And that's what we are, what we're in the middle of. Two notes, actually, that I should mention. First of all, last time I mentioned the fact that we're going to see Shlomo talks about judging all the people's cases. It sounds like there's a lot of access to the king. So I mentioned last time that was actually standard in Tanakh, about kings in Tanakh, and I quoted it as being from Rabbi Menachem Liebtag. It's not him. It's Rabbi Yitzchak et Shalom, who is the one who said that. The other point was just, if you paid attention in Shul, the Shabbos, the Haftorah that we read for Parshas Truma, came from the fifth chapter of Melachim, and it showed the link between Shlomo's wisdom and the building of the Beit HaMikdash that we just talked about. So those are notes that are worth noting. Okay, so we asked what exactly this wisdom was that Hashem gave to Shlomo. And our first approach, our question was fueled by incredulity. Like, you really think he's just going to be smarter than anybody who ever was, anybody who ever will be? Does that mean that it's, there's a cap on human wisdom? Like, that's it? No matter how smart you are, you'll never be smarter than Shlomo? And we were also bothered, as Abarbanel was bothered, because we associate wisdom with prophecy. And if so, Shlomo's superior wisdom should lead to superior prophecy. Does that make him a better prophet than Moshe? So the first approach was to limit what Shlomo received by limiting the text, meaning to say, as Radak said, perhaps Shlomo only had wisdom in the natural world, or perhaps when it says it's greater than those before him and those after him, it means only kings, or maybe it's only about the previous generation and the following generation, all sorts of ways to limit the comparison between Shlomo and others. But then, there's a whole other school of thought. And this comes to us from Don Isaac Barbanel in source number 2 on the sheet. And as I said to you at the end last time, this is a marathon, what Barbanel does. It is, by my word count, 11,636 words long, his comment on this issue. And I tried to digest it to the main points, which we're going to go through in my English translation, not in the original Hebrew, but I brought you the original Hebrew as well for those who would like to see it. Abarbanel makes 3 separate points in this piece. His first point is that Shlomo grasped more than philosophers and scholars could ever grasp because his wisdom came from others. This is not talking about knowledge now. This is talking about wisdom. Okay, by that I mean his, when I say wisdom, it's kind of an amorphous word. His analytical abilities, his intelligence, that's actually probably a better word. His intelligence was amped up by a gift from God. That's going to be his first point. So if you take a look at the English part of source number 2, the first gate, he has 3 gates. So he says, there is no doubt that Shlomo's grasp and his type of knowledge were different from the kind of grasp of philosophers and their means of knowing. Their grasp is natural, based on human analysis and thought. Shlomo's grasp was miraculous, by the good hand of God upon him. The reason he understood more than others is because God was providing him with unique intelligence. And then he breaks that down. And he says, the first path of knowing is the path of human analysis. How do you know anything? By deduction. You see things and you come to conclusions. Since human intellect is joined to the body, completing the natural material form, its means of arriving at ideas is via the senses and imagination. He says the brain is a physical thing, and that's what you use in order to come to your ideas. You have senses that perceive things, you have imagination that you use to put things together. And he goes on for quite a length of time, and he says, there are lots of ways in which that process of perception and deduction can be flawed. There are lots of things that can go wrong. He says it is clarified from all of this, meaning all of his discussion to that point, that through this first path of achieving knowledge of scientific matters according to intellectual examination and human analysis via senses and working backward from the latter to the earlier, meaning when a person deduces things from what they've perceived and they figure out what caused it, he says the 5 deficiencies I have mentioned take place. The 5 deficiencies are strain, meaning it's hard work to learn things. It's hard work to analyze things. Delay, it takes a lot of time. You can only reach so far because you only have so much time to invest. Lowliness. Certain things are just either beneath the capacity, beneath detection, I should say, or we are too low to be able to detect. Limitation. The limits of our analytical abilities. And human error. We make mistakes. We draw conclusions that aren't necessarily correct. On the other hand, he says, the second path of knowing something is not reason, but revelation. That's not his word, that's my word. Which is from the cause to that which is caused, and from the earlier to the later, meaning that God is the one who sends the information. The path of insight of the separate, meaning non-material, intellects which are before the king. He says, that's how angels work. Angels don't deduce things, they are told things. because they are simple intellect, separate from the material, and via the influence which comes upon them from God, via the malachim, the knowledge they achieve is in the second path, not in the first path. For the nature of the source is that it should be found in that which is carved therefrom. I'm not even going there. You have to go back into his thing about separate intellectual entities. It's not relevant for us. But he says, when information comes via revelation, then they are not vulnerable to the deficiencies which befall those who become wise in the first path. You don't have the same weaknesses. For their prophetic grasp does not involve strain or work or a long time or learning or analysis or lowliness of that which is grasped or limitation or errors in their grasp. None of the problems that I mentioned before happen. In other words, he says, you can learn something and you'll be limited by the time you can invest, by the tools you bring to the table, right? Those things are going to keep you from learning. However, if it's just revealed to you, the information lands in your head. That's it. He says, that's a different story altogether. And he says, if you're following on the second page, you want the third paragraph. Solomon's wisdom was of this second path. For when he asked God for a listening heart, meaning an intellect which was prepared to understand statements of understanding and to grasp truth via its analysis in the first path, when he said, I want to be able to analyze things, God responded, since you asked for this, meaning to understand, to hear justice, meaning favor and good intellect to understand the matters of justice, I have done it as you said, to give you a heart that listens, an intellect prepared to understand justice. But on top of that, I've given you a wise and understanding heart, the likes of which did not exist before you, meaning an acquired intellect and wisdom which encompasses all ideas, not via its own analysis, but as a gift from God and with higher generosity. And because of his acquisition of wisdom in the second path was miraculous via sudden divine influence, it said, there has been none like you before. There will never arise another like you, because all of the scholars before him and after him became wise in the first path of analysis. They could not escape the five deficiencies which befall human grasp. You follow? I realize that this is a lot more clear to me probably because I worked on doing the translation. That's the way it goes. But look, if you want to break your teeth on it, I can send you the whole thing. Enjoy. But the idea is that Shlomo has access to information access to processing, to intelligence that God grants Shlomo directly, and therefore it can really be above what everybody else has. I see your hand rose, but I'm just going to go through Abarbanel's idea first, and then I'll take comments and questions. That's all the first gate. The second gate is, and it's this little piece that I brought you here at the end of source number two, is that it's not just that Shlomo receives intelligence, but he also receives facts. Right? Didn't you always want to know everything just like that? That's what he had. It's just put into his brain. He just has the information. The second gate is that just as Solomon's wisdom was distinguished from the wisdom of philosophers because of his manner of grasping it and knowing it, so it was distinguished in terms of that which he knew and grasped. It's not just his manner of knowing it, but the information itself, which they did not achieve with all the wisdoms of analysis that preceded and followed him. And he goes through all these different knowledge of the spiritual world, knowledge of the physical world, practical knowledge, knowing how to govern, Torah knowledge, everything else. I didn't translate from his third gate, but what he says in his third gate is that Solomon was greater in knowledge than the prophets as well, because Abarbanel disagrees with Maimonides. We mentioned last time, there's a passage in the Talmud that says that to be a prophet, you have to acquire wisdom. You need to be a chacham. So Maimonides said, That means you have to first have the highest levels of knowledge, intellectual perfection, then you can be a prophet. Abarbanel does not believe that that's what that line in the Talmud means. It doesn't mean that. It can mean that God will give wisdom to the prophet, but what it definitely does not mean is that the greater your wisdom, the greater your prophecy. These are really two different things. If you're familiar with educational theory, multiple intelligences, right? You have some people who are intellectually very bright and emotionally completely not perceptive. And you have people who are the other way. You have people who can grasp things spatially. You have people who can memorize. You know, we all process information in different ways, and that can affect a person's skills and abilities in a particular area. Some are very verbal, some are very mathematical, and so on. So he argues for multiple intelligences, and he says, the fact that you can be really smart doesn't mean you're a great prophet. That's his third gate. Last note here, and then I'll pause for comments and questions. Malbim agrees with Abarbanel. And he makes a comment which I thought was really interesting, based on his commentary on Shir HaShirim, on Song of Songs. He says, source number 3, Ukvar he'erich morenu harav Yitzhak Abarbanel, he says, our master Abarbanel already went on at length, leva'er shezu haita, so I know there's at least one other person in the universe who read it, Malbim, because he knows, he went on at length, shezu haita mar'eg gemura nivu'it, who says that this was a full prophecy that Solomon experienced. Lo kedat harambam b'more shekatav sheshlamo lo hisig b'nevuah, not like Maimonides who says that this wasn't prophetic. See that whole discussion. And then he says, v'chein bi'arti zot b'perush shir hashirim. He says, I explain this in my commentary to Shir HaShirim, to Song of Songs, which is credited to Shlomo. Sha'al hamar'eh hazot hushar hashir harishon. The opening song in Song of Songs is about the vision that Shlomo had in our chapter. That's what he's addressing. Shemitzayer bo eich nefesh Shlomo darsha et hachochma b'derech ha'iyun. It's Shlomo seeking to become wise. That's the search that's in the first song in Song of Songs. Motvakesh la'asig d'rachah b'derech ha'nevu'i shemasig min ha'kodem ala me'uchar ha'saga pit'omit. He says, Shlomo was trying to have revealed to him the ways of knowledge prophetically, with an instantaneous revelation. And so when you see the lines where the singer says, Yishakeni minishikot pihu, the request for God to kiss him with the kisses of his mouth, Moshcheni, draw me, acharecha narutza, I will run after you, all of that is Shlomo asking God to give him wisdom. And then when it says, Hevi ani al beit hayayin, he brought me to the house of wine, that's a reference to God introducing Shlomo to wisdom. So the answer of Abarbanel and Malbim to our question is, yes, Shlomo is smarter than you, than me, than all 25 screens on this Zoom. He's got it all over us. And it doesn't matter how smart you are, and it doesn't matter how many years you labor at it, you ain't never going to get that far, because he got it as a present, gift-wrapped. It wasn't via human intellect and human achievement. Okay, Rose, thank you for waiting. You have to unmute.
So I just want to say that the fact that he was wise enough and smart enough to ask for wisdom presupposes that he had already, he was actually a chacham.
Yes.
He could have asked for anything.
Yep.
He already asked for wisdom.
Yes. He is already wise before. You may recall in chapter 2 when David talked to Shlomo and said he should take care of, so to speak, various people. He said, you are wise. You know what to do. Now, that could be a father talking to his son. Let's be fair. But you are correct. Shlomo makes a wise request before he is ever granted wisdom. We shouldn't think Shlomo is just run-of-the-mill person until, presto, this is showered upon him. He's already bright. That's for sure true. I would agree with that. Other questions and comments on this? Yes, Dahlia. Oh, we're getting there. That's
oh, all right, okay.
No, we're getting there. That's in chapter 5.
A whole other kind of wisdom with natural things, with natural phenomena like animals and other
yeah. things. I mean, absolutely. It's based in the verses of chapter 5. We'll see. It's fascinating stuff. I debated back and forth whether to throw in all of the wisdom related things with Shlomo now, and then just say when we get to chapter 5, we saw that back in chapter 3, but decided not to because there's so much we have to get to in this book, and we would be on this part of it forever. So we'll dole it out in pieces as we get to it in the text. But you are right, there's a whole body of literature on his wisdom with plants and his understanding the speech of the birds and all this stuff. It's going to be fun. Moish.
Okay, I want to add a word which I don't think I heard, but if I did, I apologize. So that's the word inspiration. Mm. And inspiration is maybe similar to what you said, but in many ways it's different. And there are two very important types of inspiration. There is the inspiration that one could say is almost a secular inspiration. A person gets a grasp of something that hasn't happened, is about to happen, is imminent or is not imminent, but may happen, and that sort of, it's not secret with a godly inspiration. But then there's another inspiration about something that is totally inchoate. It doesn't exist, and one can perhaps access this, maybe Shlomo was able to access this without God, or it has to come only with God's assistance. And I think that inspiration, that to me is what Shlomo would have been looking for.
So the word inspiration can mean a lot of different things, and I'm not sure exactly which way you're using it. Meaning to inspire can be, you know, the way we use it colloquially, to give a motivation to somebody. But we often do translate Ruach HaKodesh as divine inspiration, and I think to refer more along the lines of what we see with Shlomo here.
What I mean by inspiration is something that is beyond a person, and actually you did mention it, but may come to that person as just out of nowhere, what they call it, Ruach HaKodesh, mm-hmm. or it could be anything. But then mm-hmm. there's a higher level of inspiration that is, it's not inchoate, it's nowhere near anything. And just to answer directly, I refer to the words Ruach Elohim. That's what inspiration is. And that's, in effect, what was there at the beginning of the world was inspiration.
So I'm going to skip Ruach Elohim because that's a whole other email of yours. But
that's fine.
Yeah. So all of this sounds really nice. Sorry?
You can't see me. It's Sandra.
Yes, hi, Sandra. Right.
So
no, very true. No, I don't think it's coincidental at all. I think that's, you know, that's a biblical perspective on creativity. That this is something that is being sent by God. I think you're right. I think they are connected.
So did Bezalel need the Da'at because he was not as smart or as inspired as Shlomo was?
I mean, Bezalel is earlier.
I know that. So with Bezalel, it says Chokhma Bina and Da'at. With Shlomo, it says Chokhma Bina.
It doesn't use the word Da'at ever with Shlomo? That's interesting. I don't know. As I said to a few people in emails in advance of this session, I think you might have been one of them, that I don't intend to translate and go through the nuances of these different terms.
I'm just taken by the fact that the Bezalel was also given that, maybe, you know, to...
Yeah, but I don't know that you can read into that. I don't know that you can read into that. I'm not sure that I would go there.
Okay.
Yeah. Ricky. You just muted yourself. You're still muted.
I did. Okay, back and forth. Inspiration can be what is called epiphany. A sudden realization that it's something, it's a truth that comes
right? I mean, what we're seeing here is a magic download, so to speak, by God. You know, just downloading all of this, number one, information, and number two, ability into Shlomo. That's really what it comes down to. So all of this is really positive. It sounds wonderful. But there may be a dark side to the story as well. And I already referred to this last week, I think, in the answer to Sandra. If you take a look at source number four, it's comment from Rav Bazak, Rav Amnon Bazak. The Hebrew's at the bottom of one side, you can see the English at the top of the next side, and actually, given the length of it, I'm probably just going to stick with my English translation, I think, in the interest of time. Rav Bazak identifies two flaws in Shlomo's request. He says, it appears that one could point to two problems which emerge from his words. First, Shlomo's request, your servant is within your nation whom you chose, a large nation which cannot be counted, cannot be numbered because they are large. The bold is based on his original bolding in his Hebrew. So he keeps talking about the nation being large. And give your servant a listening heart to judge your nation, to understand between good and bad, for who could judge this heavy kaved? We talked about that word. This heavy nation of yours. So he says, look, one should match this with the portion of appointing judges in Shmot, right, in Parshas Yisro, in which Moshe was told, you will wear out, you and this nation that is with you. The matter is too heavy, same word, kaved, too heavy for you, you cannot do it alone. And then when Moshe recaps the appointment of judges at the start of Deuteronomy, he says, Hashem your God has made you large, here ba etchem. And today you are like the heavenly stars, as you are large. Kichochavei Hashemayim larov. So the terms rov and kaved show up when Moshe cannot judge the nation himself, and they show up in Shlomo's request for what he wants to do for this nation. So Rav Bazak says, Moshe and Solomon both dealt with a large and heavy nation, but Moshe understood that one person could not deal with this. So Rav Bazak says, Shlomo wants to exceed all boundaries. He wants to arrogate for himself that which Moshe said, I can't do. That's number one. And number two, he says, further, the formulation to understand between good and bad reminds us of a portion of the Garden of Eden in which the formulation of good and bad, Tov Vara, appears four times. Especially glaring, the similarity to the words of the serpent, you will be like God if you eat from the fruit, knowing good and evil. True, as of now, Shlomo does not appear to seek to be like God. We don't see that in the text. But in the future, the question will arise, regarding to what extent Shlomo is careful to preserve the appropriate distance between human being and God. We have to get there. Indeed, when God repeats Solomon's request, he omits this formulation twice. God says, I'm going to give you wisdom. He doesn't say, I'm going to give you the wisdom to know between good and bad. That's not there. This formulation is omitted from the parallel portion in Divrei HaYamim Bet, chapter 1, which praises the house of David. It skips that know between good and evil. So Rav Bazak argues that with all of the beauty and sunshine in this story, there's a dark side to all of what's going on here. And we, not Rav Bazak, but we ourselves are going to see more of that when we look at Shlomo's verdict regarding the two zonot. You can read that story again as a beautiful illustration of Shlomo's wisdom, but there's some other stuff going on there that that we have to go to. Susan.
My question is, okay, we know about Shlomo's future. We know about him overtaxing. We know about, like, what caused the downfall after him. With all his wisdom, was he lacking, if I could use the word, insight into human nature?
So,
was he unaware of the reaction to overtaxing? Was he unaware of all of having all these wives? What it was going to do?
So he's definitely aware of human nature. That becomes very clear in the next story. But that is one of the questions that we're going to have to address, is the question of, so why is it, you imagine the Jewish mother saying to her son, you're so smart, but you can't X, whatever X is, right? You're so smart. Why in the world did this happen? So that's something that we are indeed going to need to address. We're not anywhere near there yet. Janine.
I understand the criticism of Rabbi Zak, but what does he do with Pasukim that says, Vayitav Adavar Be'enei Elohim?
So,
if he asked for something that he shouldn't have asked, well, why was that being good? Hashem, please.
Right. So the answer I think he would give, I don't think he addresses that, but I think the answer he could give is that the overall request is good. The request for wisdom to judge the nation properly is good. There are just signs of trouble embedded in it. He's not a bank robber. You know, I want to hurt people, I want to whatever. However, there is a dark side to it. The big debate, which we talked about already when we asked the question of whether Shlomo is a prophet or not, is at what point do the problems begin? The things that we're going to see evolve into a disaster later on, are the seeds already here? And Rabbi Zak is arguing that they are. Yeah, not that the whole thing is bad, but there are problems already. Dahlia.
It seems like arrogance, and that's...
That's pretty bad, yes.
Yeah, along the lines of what everybody is saying, because I'm agreeing with everybody, and those are some of the points I was going to make, but I just wanted to say, it reminds me of the expression, be careful what you ask for, because you might get it.
Yep.
So he asked for this, and there's a reason why God never gave this gift again to anyone, because look what, you know... People, like they always say, if only I were smarter. If I were only smarter, I would know this. I could do this. I could cure cancer. I could fix the climate change and everything else. But sometimes it leads to a certain arrogance, number one, which is what you just pointed out. It seems like it leads to being conceited and it leads to character flaws that he develops later. He develops like some really, really serious character flaws.
So, yeah.
I think that it's kind of like, be careful if you ask for too much wisdom, because God could give it to you, and you might get this present, but...
So we're going to see the dark side of this. I'm not sure I would agree with the contention that this is why God doesn't give this gift to anyone else, just because, number one, God already says in the beginning, when he gives him the gift, I'm never giving this to anyone else, before anything goes bad with it. But number two, because going back to what we had said originally, there's a unique purpose to doing this. He's trying to create a particular kind of society. But there's so much more to talk about. I'm going to go further with it. You have to read the last sentence in this section. It's a sentence that's easy to miss in the excitement of getting all that wisdom. But take a look at chapter 3, sentence 15. Vayikat Shlomo, vihine chalom. He woke up, it was a dream, and the commentators all jumped for joy, because, hey, Paro did that, right? There's a lot of commentary on that. But one basic point that's suggested is when he woke up, it seemed like a dream. When he was sleeping, it was clear as day. It was completely lucid. I'm talking to God, and it's only when he wakes up, he says, oh, wow, I was sleeping when all of that happened. Keep on reading. Vayavo Yerushalayim, he came to Jerusalem, where his father had built an altar. Right, there's no Beit HaMikdash at this point, but his father built him his Be'ah. Vayamod lifnei Aron bris Hashem, and he stood before the Aron of God that was now there. Vayal olos vayas shlamim, he brought offerings to God. Vayas mishte lechol avadav. Achashverosh, huh? He made a feast for all of his servants. Why the feast? Says Rashi, if you look at source number 5 on your sheet, vayas mishte misimchas libo, due to his joy, shehivin shchalomo amet. He said, wow, it's all true. He understood that this had actually become true, and the Midrashim explained, how does he know that it's true? And this goes back to what Dahlia was noting before, that he heard the birds talking, and he understood what they were saying. He heard the animals, and he understood what they were saying, and he said, wow, this really is true. But again, I'm waiting with that to chapter 5. So to summarize where we are, Hashem makes the Beis HaMikdash and Shlomo's utopia come into existence by giving Shlomo the wisdom he requests, as well as the wealth and honor that he did not request. The wisdom is maybe just the natural world, maybe it's just greater than previous generation and the next generation, or, no, greater than everybody, as Abarbanel thinks it's a special divine gift, even though it doesn't make him a prophet. And that brings us to the story of the Zonot. I'm kind of assuming, I've been assuming that people are somewhat familiar with this story. But don't worry, we're going to go through it. The basic story, in a nutshell, two women who are described as Zonot come before Shlomo, and the idea of being Zonot is taken, although we'll see some nuance, but basically, literally, the way we usually use the term, they are prostitutes, and the description is that they both had babies, and they went to sleep one night, there was nobody else around, and one of them wakes up to find that she's holding a dead baby. And she says, as they come before Shlomo, I looked at it and realized it wasn't mine. And then I saw the other one, and she was lying with a baby. That was my baby. And what must have happened is, she smothered the baby during the night, and then she took mine, but that's really mine. And the other one says, what are you talking about? This is my baby. This is my living baby. What are you starting trouble for? And Shlomo hears the case, and Shlomo's answer is, take a sword, cut the baby in half. That's what you do in halacha, right? If there's property and two parties have a claim to the property and you don't know who's right, all right, so we split the property. So that's what we're going to do. Never mind that that's not actually what you do in halacha if you're dealing with property that can't be split. Instead, you sell it off and, you know, you keep it intact. So that's a discussion in the Gemara of Bava Basra. But that's what he says. And of course, one woman says, oh no, don't do that. You know, let her have the baby. And the other one says, nah, cut him in half. And so Shlomo says, the one who had mercy on the baby, that's the one. And everybody's very impressed. So there's a whole lot we have to understand about this story. This story is not nearly as simple as everyone thinks it is. You have to read it carefully. First note, just to mention it, is that this is also the Haftorah for Parshas Miketz, when Miketz is not Chanukah. Miketz is almost always Chanukah. But it can happen that it isn't. It actually happened last year. Not this past Hanukkah, but the Hanukkah before it. Hanukkah 5781. It's going to happen again in just a couple of years. 5784. And then it doesn't happen after that for another 17 years. It happens, but it's rare that Miketz is in Hanukkah. The links between the Parsha of Miketz and this Haftorah include, as I mentioned, the king waking up and behold, it was a dream. That's found in the Parsha. It's actually not found it's not part of the story of the Zonot. It's the pasuk right before it. That's how it begins. Vayikach Shlomo. So that's one connection. Another connection is because Miketz has Yosef crediting the divinely granted wisdom that he received. Rav Moshe Lichtenstein also says that, you know, both Yosef and Shlomo put on a show in order to draw out the true nature of the people before them. Shlomo does it with the sword, and Yosef does it with his brothers. The whole game with imprisoning Shimon and Binyamin. There's more to be said about links between them. I just wanted to mention at least something. So the first question we have to ask before we read the text of the story is this. Is the story a positive or a negative for Shlomo? Is this story with the Zonot, where Shlomo figures it out and all of that, is the story a positive or a negative for Shlomo?
It's positive, but by the way you ask it, it sounds like...
Right, like, Tochina, why are you asking this question? Obviously the answer... By the fact that you're asking, it must be that there's a negative. So, you are right.
Even you ain't done, that yes.
So the story itself is taken almost universally as, yes, it is a positive story. Abarbanel actually says it's a setup. If you take a look at source number 6, he says, Sipera katuv shemiyad ba'oto ayom kara shaba'o shtena shim zonot el ha-melech. He says the text tells us that day, that very day, these two zonot show up in front of the king. Lefishi kra Hashem lefanav anisayon hazeh lehorot al chochmato. Hashem has set it up in order for him to have a chance to demonstrate his wisdom. I hope that doesn't mean that Hashem killed the child for the sake of demonstrating Shlomo's wisdom. I think it's more likely he's hinting at source number 7, the Medrash in Shir Hashirim, Shir Hashirim Rabbah. Take a look at source number 7. Mi hayu, the Medrash says, who are these women? Rav Amar Ruchot hayu. Rav says, these are spirits. They're not human beings at all. And I think that's what Abarbanel is referring to when he says this is a setup. This is God creating a scenario in which Shlomo will have the opportunity to show off his wisdom. Rabbanan Amrin Yevamot Hayu. The sages said they were Yevamot. Yevamot can mean multiple things, but basically they are women whose Yibum situation was dependent on each other. A long story. There's a Meiri in Yevamos who goes through this all about how the story with the two women involved levirate marriage, involved Yibum. I'm not going there. It is so complicated and so confusing and so not in line with what you read in the Psukim that I just said, you know what? If anybody wants it, I could give you a link where there's an article on jlaw.com where he tries to walk you through it, but I'm not going there. Rabbi Simon quotes Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi to say, no, these were Zonot Mamash. This was a real life story involving real normal people. And that's the way it happened. In terms of the wisdom of Shlomo, that's illustrated here, Rabbi Adam Friedman in my Beit Midrash read out source number 8. You know, we have the column in our Toronto Torah every week with Journey Through Tanakh. So when we did this chapter in it, Rabbi Friedman noted the association with source number 8. This is Yeshaya. For those who did Yeshaya with me, you may remember this. The prediction of a Mashiach who can judge cases through Ruach Hashem. I didn't bring you a translation. You have a Tanakh. You can look it up. But it describes how he will have the Ruach of Hashem, the Spirit of God, Chochma Ubina, Eitza Ogvura, wisdom, understanding, counsel, might. He's got Da'as, this, I don't know what to call it, intelligence perhaps, Yiras Hashem, reverence for God. And it continues to say he can judge cases without, not based on his eyes, not based on his ears, just based on his sense of smell. That's it. He's able to just tune into justice. So Shlomo's judgment comes from that kind of divine aid that's being predicted there. So you could read the story as positive. Shlomo is tapping into divinely granted wisdom to handle this case. It's wonderful. And again, that's almost universal. However, we already noted, Divrei Hayamim Bet, chapter 1, records the dream in which Hashem gives Shlomo wisdom. Hashem saying, ask me for something, I'll give you. Shlomo saying, please make me wise so I can judge them. That's there. However, it skips the story of the Zonot. That's weird. We've said many times that Divrei Hayamim, the goal of Divrei Hayamim, of this chronicle, is to support the greatness of the house of David. So that the Jews in the beginning of the Second Temple will follow the Davidic dynasty. Why would you skip such an awesome story? Why would you leave that out? So Rav Nachum Rabinovich, Alav HaShalom, said something about this that some of you have already started to feed into. In an essay which he didn't write in English, he wrote it in Hebrew, but it's available online on the Lehrer House website, with an English translation from Eli Fisher. I gave you the link there in source number 9. He says, by comparing the descriptions of Divrei Hayamim with those of Milachim, we find that with regard to everything relating to the realization of the prophecy, Divrei Hayamim repeats what was already stated in Milachim, and even embellishes it, with one exception. In Divrei Hayamim, as in Malachim, it is recounted that, quote, wisdom and knowledge are granted to you, to the extent that all the kings of the earth came to pay homage to Shlomo and to listen to the wisdom with which God had endowed him. However, the amazing tale of how Shlomo's wisdom was first revealed to Israel when, quote, they saw that he possessed divine wisdom to execute justice, That whole story does not appear in Divrei HaYamim. The absence of the episode of the two mothers from Divrei HaYamim is perplexing, for there would seem to be no greater exhibition of Shlomo's extraordinary wisdom. And he says, the sages have already expressed this puzzle and illuminated a path to understanding that precisely what seems to be the supreme expression of a wise and discerning mind was not simply a gift from God. And it in fact pushed him into the abyss of destruction. Good phrase, no? This is not the present it seems to be. There are problems, and this goes back to what several of you said, right? This was Dahlia's comment, this was what we were pointing to. All in good time, when we get to chapter 10, chapter 11, we'll have to talk about this. But it fits with what we said from Rav Bazak, that Shlomo is perhaps going to a place that isn't entirely safe. So we're going to come back to this point at the end of the story altogether. We have a lot to say on this in terms of this story, but I wanted to put it out there up front that the story is not all sunshine and rainbows. Okay? Don't look at the rainbows. Okay. So, let's look at the story. Chapter 3, sentence 16. Az tavona shtayim nashim zonot el hamelech vata'amodna lefanav. Two women, Zonot, came before the king, and they stood before him. As I said, before, last week, Rabbi Shalom notes, in general in Tanakh, there is easy access to kings. It's not hard to get in to see the king, Ahasuerus being the exception to that rule. Zonot. So it's generally accepted, as I said before, these are actual Zonot. Abar Benel says that's actually part of what makes Shlomo's feat so impressive. Take a look at source number 10. He says, and this is, cultural thing, Hein hayu nashim Zonot asher ein bahem busha uchlima. They were shameless, he says. He says, Vayu ma'azot pneihen. They were bold. Ba'amor kol achas mehen b'ni achayu b'nei chameis. Each one boldly said, my son's the live one, your son is the dead one. Ve'al kol ze yarad ha'melech letochen ha'inyan. And yet, king is able to descend to the heart of the matter. V'hikira mitad ha'davar mitoch divrayen. He recognized the truth from their words. U'le'emet hotzi mishpat. And he produced true justice. So these are Zonot. Part of the role of the Zonah is to be able to lie, to tell people what they want to hear, and Shlomo is able to get through all of that and figure out what's correct. He also, Barbanel also notes that the case comes straight to Shlomo. Two women come straight to the king. It didn't go through the hierarchy of courts with each one kicking it upstairs. There's been no analysis beforehand. No one's investigated. Shlomo is the first one. I did want to note, Ralbag says, no, they're innkeepers who may also be involved in other stuff. And this goes back to discussions we've had regarding Rachav, regarding Yiftach's mother and Shoftim. This is an old discussion in commentary to Tanakh. Okay, so they stand before the king. Vatomer ha'isha ha'achat, bi adoni. One of the women said, bi adoni. Usually we take bi adoni to mean please, but bi doesn't have to mean that. Those who were in my shir that I did about Chana a few weeks ago recall that I said that then. Bi can mean literally in me. And that's the way Abarbanel reads it here. Bi adoni, me, my master. Listen to my claim. I'm the one telling the truth. Ani v'ha'isha hazot yoshvot b'bayit echad. This woman and I were sitting in one house. Vo'eilei ma b'bayit. And I gave birth with her there in the house. And the point is, continue sentence 18. V'hi b'yom ha'shalishi l'liti, 3 days later. V'telet gam ha'isha hazot, she also gave birth. V'anachnu yachdav. And we were together. Ein zar itanu b'bayit. There's no one around. No witnesses. Zulati shtayim anachnu babayit. It's just the two of us in this house. Of course, normally there would have been traffic in the house. Now there's nobody. Vayomad ben ha'isha hazot laila. And this other woman's kid died. At night, one night, asher shachvalav, she lay on it. Vatakam b'soch ha'laila. So she got up during the night. Vatikach es bini meyetzli, and she took my kid. Va'amascha yishena. I, your servant, royal servant that I am, I was sleeping. Vatashkiveu becheika. She put the child in her arm. Ve'ezbena ames hishkiva becheiki, and she put the dead child in my arm. Va'akumba boker lehenik es bini behine meis. And I got up in the morning, I wanted to nurse my kid. He's dead. And then by light of day, I looked at him. I examined him. Lihit bonein is to contemplate. Like I looked closely. That's not my son. That's her son. And the other woman says, it's not so. Your kid, my kid is the living one, your kid is the dead one. Vizos Omeris, and the original woman, I'm gonna call them plaintiff and defendant. I find that to be the best way to do this, to distinguish them, short of assigning names. So the plaintiff comes back and says, Lochi, it's not so. B'nei Chameis, u'b'nei Achai. Your son's the dead one, my son's the live one. Vatidaberna lefnei HaMelech. And they spoke in front of the king. Notice those last three words. They spoke in front of the king. One of the participants here in the shiur emailed me some time back to ask me about times when we quote sentences in Tanakh and put them in quotation marks on the sheet. Does that mean that when you see somebody speaking in Tanakh, it's, you know, word for word, their words? So the answer is that that is the assumption that you bring to the table. When you see it say, and so-and-so said, that is the assumption. Here it's certainly true. Because you had quotes, and then it says, and they spoke in front of the king. That's where it's not literal. So these words are literal. We're going to see in a moment, Rabbi Yitz Shalom, when he reads this, says it has to be so, for reasons that we're going to come back to. But take a look on your sheet at source number... Did I put it on there? Thought I put it on there. Hang on. Yes, source number 11. Radak says, what is Vatidaberna that they spoke before the king? Ela ha-ta'anot. These claims, shanu v'shilshu lifnei ha-melech. They repeated them. They said it a third time in front of the king. I'm right. You know. Kaminag ba'alei adin. Like litigants. Shekol achat. Chonebe ta'anosav lechosko lehitivo lehavino leshofeit. You repeat it, you want to strengthen it, you want to make sure the judge understood what you were saying. And then look what Shlomo does. Pasuk Chav Gimel. Vayomer HaMelech, the king said, Zos omeres zebni achai ubnei chameis. This one says, this is my son, the living one, and your son's the dead one. Vizos omeres lochi bnei chameis ubnei achai. And this one says, it's not so. Your son is the dead one. My son is the live one. Isn't that interesting what Shlomo just did? What in the world is that about? He did not add one element to what they said. He did not add one element to the story. Like, what in the world is this doing here? Take a look at source number 12. The Talmud Yerushalmi is bothered by this. It's also a Medrash in Devarim Rabbah. Amar Rabbi Simon, I'm sorry, I stopped translating there. I wanted to at least keep this to two pages. Rabbi Simon said, it's Sarich Hadayan Lishnot Ta'anotehen. He says, you're a judge, you have to repeat the claims that the litigants made. Shenamar, like it says here, look what Shlomo did. This one says this. You learn that that's what a judge should do. It's not just judges, right? This is a sign of a good listener. A good listener says, this is what I took from what you said, matching it up. It's good for the speaker to have the listener do that. Shows I was understood, and it gives an opportunity also to make sure that what you understood was actually what they intended in the first place. So that's one way to look at it. Shlomo's doing what judges should do. Then Isaac Abarbanel says no. What Shlomo's doing is he's saying, I have nothing to go on here. All I have is you say this and you say this. Take a look at source number 13, Abarbanel. He says, "V'ef Shalomar, you could say, Shalafisha Isha Shadibra Rishna Sipra Dvarim Harbei, the first woman went on at length, right? The first speaker in here got a few psukim. You know, and I had a baby, and then she had a baby, and I went to sleep, and I woke up in the morning, and I was going to nurse the baby. She did this whole long story. And there's no witness to either one's version of it. So the king says to her, to the plaintiff, what good is all the stuff you said if you don't have witnesses? You say this, and she says that. All we have here is you say your son's the live one and not the dead one. And that other woman, she says her son's the live one and your son's the dead one. And everything else, you know, has no relevance. So Shlomo is dropping the rest of the story that she said and saying, okay, all I really have here are the claims. That's all I have, and everything else is just window dressing and meaningless. That's the way Abarbanel reads it. But the commentators zero in on this sentence because there's stuff going on here. You know that someone like Malbim is going to look at this and say, Shlomo did this for a reason. And that's what we're gonna come back to. What does Shlomo do? Sentence 24. Vayomer HaMelech, Kechuli Charev. He says, bring me a sword. I guess he's not like Shaul, right? Shaul always has a weapon at hand. Although it's a chanid, it's a spear. That wouldn't work as well. Vayaviyu HaCharev Lefnei HaMelech. And they bring the sword before the king. Vayomer HaMelech, Gizru Es HaYelad HaChai Lishnayim. So he says, cut the living one in half. Usnu Es HaChatzi LeAchatz VeSachati LeAchatz. So give half to one, give half to the other. And again, popular understanding is what we said when we introduced the story. This is a test. Vatomer ha'isha shebena achai al ha'melech. So the one whose son is the living one says to the king, ki nechmeru rachmeha al bana, she has mercy on her son. Rabbi Yit Shalom in his shir on this pointed out that that's another possible connection to Miketz, because we say of Yosef, nechmeru rachamav el achiv, he had mercy on Binyamin. Same phrase. The Vatomer, bi Adoni, and she says, bi Adoni, and again that bi, Abarbanel says, doesn't mean please. It means, in me, I should suffer. Tenula es hayalodachai, give her the live kid. Ve'ameis altami suhu, don't kill him. Vizo somaris, and the other one says, no. Gamli gamach, lo yiye. I won't get, you won't get, let's be fair. Gizoru, cut the kid in half. Vayanam, the king says, oh, okay, so give that other one the baby, okay? Give the one who wanted to keep the baby alive, please. She should be the one who gets it. There are so many problems in this story. There are so many things in this ending that don't make any sense. For example, once one woman says to the other one, take the baby, what does the other one say back? No, cut it in half. Right, Joyce, I see your face. Like, what are you doing? No, take the baby and run. That didn't make any sense. How about this? Who was right, the plaintiff or the defendant? Which one ends up with the baby?
Well, the defendant was definitely the right person.
Do you see anything in the text to tell you that?
Because if you're a woman and a mother, you know that you will do anything for your child not to die.
But how do you know who it was? But how do you know who the plaintiff was and who the defendant was? It didn't say. At the end, it just said, one woman said and one woman said. So it's 2:30, and you're gonna have to either, you have to do one of two things. Start reading ahead on the story sheet, or wait till next week. But oh boy, do we have a lot to talk about.
Oh my God,
Rabbi, it does say.
This story is really strange.
Rabbi.
Yes.
It does say, V'toma ha'isha asher pna ha'chai.
Yeah. The one whose son is the living one.
The live one.
I don't know which one that is. It doesn't say the one who was holding the live one originally. It just says the one who's the right mother. But we don't know whether that's the plaintiff or the defendant. And the story doesn't seem to care. So we have to come back and explain this, God willing, next week.
Next week.
All right.